Hey everybody, this is Mike with the Mountain Weekly News. Welcome back to episode number 20 of Everything Snowboarding and More. Thank you for tuning in this week. We're going to start off this week with some resort news. First up is, this is actually a question for our readers and our listeners. What do you think is the largest ski resort in North America? Now some of you are probably saying Vail. Maybe some of you up in Canada are saying Whistler. What if I told you it was neither of the two? Turns out the largest ski resort in North America, as far as acres is concerned, is Powder Mountain in Utah. Powder Mountain comes in at 8,654 acres. The reason we're talking about Powder Mountain, better known as Pow Mow, is this. This year, Powder Mountain is only going to sell 1,500 lift tickets per day and only going to allow 3,000 season pass holders per day. That means that Powder Mountain is going to have a lift capacity of no more than 4,500 people a day on that mountain. When you compare that to Vail, last year Vail saw 1.63 million people skier visits. So again, Powder Mountain in Utah, this is a really cool, hopefully other resorts get this. I think limiting the number of day passes is great for the skier experience. It probably sucks if you're the person that's number 1,501 and you don't get to ski. But for everybody else, that kind of skier experience, that's why we go skiing, not to stand in lift lines. And as far as the danger component, you know, if you're skiing around and you got people whizzing by you. So Powder Mountain in Utah, be sure to check those guys out. In Colorado, we've got some fun Colorado resort news. There is a new private ski resort being built in Colorado. It's called the Cimarron. Cimarron is going to be located in the San Juans of Colorado. This private resort is a members-only resort. You have to actually buy a home. Homes start, or the lots start at $3.2 million. This is a 15 to 35 acre lot. Along with the payment for the real estate, each year you'll pay $55,000 to $65,000 a year in membership fees. So what does this get you? This gets 1,750 acres of private snowcat skiing, helicopter skiing, and just lift access skiing as well. 1,750 acres, that's more skiable terrain than Aspen. So again, private ski resort, if you've got, you know, an extra $5-10 million, you're looking for something to do with it, this is a great investment in Colorado as far as the future of skiing in that zone. Currently, we've got 8 ski resorts open in North America, with 2 of those being located in Colorado. Arapahoe Basin was the first to open. Super white ribbon of death. I don't know if you saw the photos. I'll post one up. There was a lift line that extended almost half the way up the mountain. It was comical at best. So along with A-Basin, Loveland is also open in Colorado now. Lookout Pass up in Montana, they're open for skiing. I think they've got a bunch of pow up there. Timberline in Oregon's open. Down in the Midwest, Wild Mountain in Minnesota is open for the ski season. I've never been to Wild Mountain. I've heard good things. And Trollhagen, hopefully some of our Midwestern readers and listeners can clue me in on that one. That's in Wisconsin. They're also open. And then up in Canada, we've got a couple resorts open, one in Banff, the Mount Norquay, and then in Alberta, Naksua Ski Resort is open. So ski season's off to a great start. We've got tons of snow. Interior British Columbia is going off. The Tetons are going off. There is a bunch of snow. A couple weeks ago, I talked about the La Nina weather forecast. We are 1,000% sure that's coming through. I've gone on record. It's going to be a better winter than last year. People are saying better than last year. You know, Jackson was all time. Well, you won't remember last year after this winter. It's going to be that good. So get excited. Tons of snow coming. I actually had a chance to go out in the Tetons 4 days ago. I went out touring up on Togedy Pass. There was about 3 to 4 feet of fresh snow. It had snowed 16 inches overnight. I went out and toured with my dog. I posted up a link to the video. I was testing out the Union Expedition splitboard bindings. And I definitely want to give you some feedback on those bindings. So what we have now is Union. Union is definitely the leader in snowboard bindings. Nobody really comes close to them. I think now maybe a second, Burton is third. But I feel that Union has just been making incredible snowboard bindings for so many years. So when they decided to come into the splitboard market, we were super excited. I first got a chance to look at the stuff last winter down at the SIA trade show, and I've had the chance to actually put my feet in the bindings and go tour. These bindings, they feel so amazing in the hand. The way the high back feels, the actual binding, I mean, this is a true snowboard binding. You're not going to look at it and say, oh, I don't know, this is a splitboard binding, this is a, you know, more of a mountaineer binding. No, this is an actual snowboard binding. So that they definitely have going for them. It looks amazing. It feels great. Tour is really nice too. You know, it does have the pin system in the front, and as long as you get the pin all the way through that front, latch, you're good to go. But if you for some reason don't put the pin all the way through, there's a chance that you can kind of kick your foot off the board when you're in ski mode. When it comes to putting the board together, it goes together really nice and smooth. There is a little bit of setup involved. I think it took about 30 minutes for me to set up the board originally. Then once I got on snow, I was able to do transitions within about 5 minutes. The only hiccup comes when you actually put your feet in this board. The discs and the binding spin a little bit. I would say 1 to 2 degrees in both directions. Normally, I would never ride a board like this. However, I believe this is the way that these bindings are going to ride based on how they are built. So it does take a little bit of getting used to. It was unnoticeable on the way down. I was surfing pow, it was super floaty, I was like woo. However, again, the bindings do tend to spin. So my plan is to use these bindings for the entire season, to get a full season, test a bunch of different boards with them, and really just make sure that these bindings hold up. We're still telling people that they should check them out. It's definitely a great binding. I think that price-wise, it's kind of right in the middle. It might even be a little bit less than some of the other guys. And it's a union. So for somebody that's looking to go from snowboarding, a Capita fan, a union fan, this is definitely going to be an easy sell for that person. So again, union, expedition binding. We'll see how it lasts, but so far, so good. On to the Olympics. This year, Burton Snowboards and the North Face just announced that they are going to be dialing out our United States snowboard and ski team athletes with their uniforms. Burton's going to take care of the snowboard crew while the North Face is going to do the skiers. Honestly, I think both kits are going to be pretty wild and stand out. Burton's kind of has a space age design, a moon boot colorway. It's definitely a homage to the NASA space system. So the Burton stuff will be kind of cool. And then TNF, the North Face, whatever they do outerwear-wise is solid. So the skiers are stoked. Okay, what else? As far as the industry is concerned, we're actually going to take a break here and go on to an interview that I did with Neil and Ian Provo. These guys have been just crushing it in Utah. They have been the face of backcountry skiing, splitboarding, touring, mountaineering, just getting out there and having a rad time. So I've got a fun interview with Nian and Neil Provo coming up, and after that, we'll get back to it. So thanks again for tuning in. This is episode number 20 of Everything Snowboarding and More.
Whoops, there we go. Cool. Basically what I wanted to talk to you guys about is, obviously, you've got a part in the new Warren Miller film, and we wanted to talk to you about obviously the film, as well as what backcountry skiing and splitboarding means to both of you. And so I guess we could start with the backcountry component. What is the drive for you guys to go out and be self-powered going into the mountains?
For me, this is Ian speaking. I think for me, it's just a progression of where skiing has taken me over the course of my life. Ever since the very, very beginning to where I'm at right now, it just seems like kind of the natural progression to go, into the mountains where there's basically just nothing but just mountains, and just being self-sustained and all those aspects really really draw me in at this point.
Yeah, that's the same for me, just the sport growing so much, both skiing and snowboarding, resorts just getting a lot more crowded year after year, I just find it so much more enjoyable in the backcountry where there's less people and more opportunities to get fresh spines. And
yeah, it seems like it's more of like a quality over quantity nowadays, where, you know, before when we're growing up, we're all about just spinning as many laps as possible. But now it seems more important to find like a good quality experience, and that's pretty much mostly found for us, you know, up in the mountains, away from the resorts and other facilities and stuff.
Yeah. And same can be said for your body, too. It's a lot metal around your body, I think, ski touring and split boarding, as compared to hammering laps at the resort, like day in, day out. It's just a nice balance to be able to get a little bit of exercise on the way up and keep your body in shape, not really deal with the chatter and the moguls of the resort as much.
Yeah, I like what you guys said about, you know, just going out and getting the quality over the quantity. And, you know, it seems like that's definitely one of the drives to the backcountry, you know, especially going out and getting fresh tracks and, you know, even just one good lap as compared to, you know, maybe a chunder day at the resort that's been chewed up. And it seems like the backcountry component's growing so big. For what you guys see, I mean, you're out in the backcountry all the time. What good safe practices are you seeing other people do, and what practices are you seeing that maybe are some red flags that people could work on for safety in the backcountry?
Yeah, you know, it's tough. Like, you know, experience in the backcountry is something that comes over time, you know, and what we're seeing a lot nowadays is a lot of people getting into it quickly because it's a lot more accessible nowadays with the equipment and with all the exposure on social media and all that stuff. So I think we're starting to find, you know, a lot of people out who are in process. And, you know, I think it's just really important for people who are getting into it to, you know, dive deep into their local avalanche center. You know, those are just, and, you know, it's really a good guideline for most people to follow when making decisions in the backcountry for the most part. So, yeah, I don't know. It's definitely a changing environment with, you know, the instant, like, you know, exposure from the internet and stuff. You know, people are seeing things immediately and, you know, certain areas are getting blown out, you know, sooner than others. And so it's just a little bit different of an environment.
And how about from an industry standpoint, do you feel that we're promoting backcountry safety? You know, if somebody buys a split board and it's kind of like, okay, you're off, you know, good luck. Or, you know, if somebody buys a set of AT skis, could there be a different message that's maybe relayed through the brands and through the industry as a whole?
I think so, for sure. I mean, there's some brands that are doing a pretty good job of it. But I do think that the awareness could be driven home a little bit harder, especially with those products specifically, to get people a little bit more educated. But there's kind of like a mix. I feel like there's some brands that kind of like glorify like the whole avalanche thing and the danger aspect, and they, you know, that's like part of the whole extreme side of things. But in reality, that's not like, it's not cool to like get caught in an avalanche at any point in time. Whether you get a great shot of it, like, that's pretty irrelevant, you know, like, that shouldn't have happened in the first place. So, definitely, you know, we need more brands, and we need more people to, you know, continue to spread knowledge and education to people who are getting into it, because, yeah, we're at a time right now where there's probably more backcountry users than there ever was. And we also have access to information like never before. So, you know, should allow for people to continue to do it safely, as long as they're aware of what they're getting into and they're, you know, tapping into that information.
For sure, and I like that you hit home about, you know, the avalanche. And I mean, it's, you know, if you've gotten caught in an avalanche, you fucked up, and there's nothing, you know, nothing to glorify that. Do you guys both wear airbags when you're in the backcountry?
It just kind of depends. We both have them, and we use them a lot in, up north in Alaska, but not so much in Utah. And I guess it just depends on the conditions and the terrain. You know, there's certain days where we go out and ski where we're, you know, like 100% confident we're not going to need to get, you know, need to use an avalanche airbag. We're skiing stuff, and we're confident we're not going to get into that type of situation. But then there's skiing situations like what Neil said up in Alaska, where, you know, the terrain really allows for those airbags to work properly. You know, it's kind of a no-brainer. But, you know, where we live, we ski a lot in tight trees and stuff. And, you know, again, I think with the technology improving, like, it'll probably become a no-brainer for everybody, but right now with the weight, it just kind of doesn't really, it's not necessary. You know, as long as you can be confident in your decision-making, then you'll never need an airbag pack, unless obviously some sort of freak accident. But
I'm definitely interested in using one more.
Yeah.
As the technology is better and yeah, stuff gets lighter. I don't see a reason why not to use one every single day if it's not, like, terribly heavy, you know?
Yeah.
And since you guys, I mean, obviously you guys are pretty dialed in the backcountry, what type of avalanche education do you both have?
Just level ones. Yeah, we took level one course probably 12 or 13 years ago. But really, the bulk of our experience and knowledge comes just from, you know, just experience and being out in the mountains a lot and studying up on our own with the vast amount of information, knowledge that's out there within, you know, books and the internet and also, you know, with other more experienced people out in the backcountry. You know, that's really helpful if you're getting into it to have someone who can show you around and teach you some things.
I think having a good mentor is huge.
It's for sure great.
One of the most important things in this sport is having somebody that can show you. Otherwise, it's a lot steeper of a learning curve, a lot more dangerous, you know, if you don't have somebody who kind of knows what they're doing, showing you the way.
But on the contrary, like, in this day and age, you know, all that information is pretty much at your fingertips. So if you're curious about it, and, you know, we've had enough exposure to you know, some incidents where it's like, okay, this is the real deal, and if we're going to be out here, we need to take this extremely, you know, we need to take it very seriously at all times. So just being really in tune and, like, I don't know, just having the knowledge, you feel safer, but at the same time, you feel a little bit more vulnerable, too, so.
Do you guys do much riding at ski resorts these days?
Last year was actually the first year, since we were both 2 years old, that we didn't get a ski pass. But I think this year we got a pass again to the canyons in Park City. But not much. Mostly it's like in the early season to, you know, get the legs firing, get all the muscles tuned in. But it's just, you know, the resort that we ride at here locally, it's called the Canyons here in Park City. It's changed so much over from when we grew up, you know, learning to ride around there. And the whole experience just isn't what it was. And so I find myself there a lot less nowadays.
Yeah, I spent 10 years in Colorado, so I know the Vail experience and what that can do to mountains for sure.
Yeah, it's gnarly.
Yeah. As far as Warren Miller, you know, this is, I think, the 68th film that he's done. And what was that like filming with those guys this year?
Man, this year was pretty much like, it was almost like a dream trip for us, like that we just sort of happened upon, you know. We didn't really know about it. We just got an email one day asking if we were available. It was pretty early in the season. It was the first week of December, so I was actually down in Nicaragua for a month surfing, and I hadn't even skied yet or snowboarded or power surfed or anything, and literally got home from that trip and packed my bag and went right up there. And so it was just kind of like the way it all came to be and how it happened and the conditions we had and, you know, the situation, like being able to power surf in a snowcat for a week straight was like literally the dream scenario for us. We've been thinking about it for years and years and years and never really thought it would just happen like that so easily. So super lucky.
Can you explain pow surfing to people that maybe are listeners that have never surfed, or how would you explain pow surfing to them?
It's kind of like a mix between snowboarding, skateboarding, and surfing. Take a snowboard and take the bindings off and lay down some traction and just use like a Sorel style boot. And you just literally use the force of the snow pushing against your board to keep it on, you know, keep pressure on your feet, like similar to the way that the water works on the surfboard. Another way to describe it is like, imagine when snowboarding was first invented. You know, that's like the original board was back in the day. They created these boards. They didn't have bindings back in the day. They were just riding soft snow with these boards. And so pow surfing
was only created out of necessity to be able to
progress. Right, and to do them more things and stuff. And exactly. And so nowadays, here we are in 2017, and it's like, all right, everything's been done. It seems natural to go back to sort of the roots and the original concept of this board. That it seems like it's almost like this forgotten way of riding, and it's amazing. It's the most amazing, type of ride that I've ever experienced on snow, and I've done everything. So have that feeling, you know, almost 30 years after I started this whole skiing thing, is pretty insane. It's basically these boards are just very, very, very primitive snowboards from, you know, the late 60s and 70s, but just kind of obviously with some new technology, you know, there's a lot of different shapes and varieties to choose from, but at the end of the day, it's just a wooden board.
And it's great how somebody like yourself that, you know, has so much experience in the mountains, you know, 30 years, you know, on snow, all of a sudden you can look at terrain very differently and get on that pow surfer and just be like 10 years old again or 12 years old. And it just like completely opens up like, oh my gosh, I'm just going to go out and be a little kid again.
Exactly. Yeah, it's been really refreshing going back now. Like now we're starting to ride bigger lines. Like we've made these pow surfers into split boards. So we're now starting to tour into terrain that we've been skiing, backcountry skiing for the last 10 years, and going back and riding lines that we used to ride on skis and snowboards, and we're doing it without bindings. And it's like, all of a sudden, we're able to look at the mountains in a whole new way. And it's just amazing to have that new, totally new, fresh perspective. And it's exciting and challenging, like, I've never experienced before, you know. So it's not something just to go like play around with when you're bored. Like this for me is like the real deal. Like I could focus a lot of energy on trying to ride lines without bindings.
For sure. You guys have both been with Volley for quite some time. I mean, I think as long as we can remember. How's that relationship been, and how did you guys first get involved with them? They're Salt Lake based, right?
I was working with them for about 5 years. I actually don't ride their gear anymore. Long story short, I went to Volley, and they didn't really have any team at that point or anybody kind of riding their equipment. Other than just regular customers, so I pitched them an idea to try to get them a little more brand awareness and try to get some other folks riding their boards, and worked great for a few years, and then they just kind of shit canned the whole athlete program last year.
Oh, interesting. Who's supporting you guys this year then?
I'm working with Outdoor Research, Backcountry.com, Smith Optics, and Hyperlite Mountain Gear, and DJ Snowboards this year.
Oh, sick.
Good run. I have a lot of respect for that company, you know, since they brought the slipboard to the masses, you know. But it's just, I feel like they're kind of stuck in the past in terms of, like, board shapes, ideas, graphics, marketing, everything.
I agree, and even though this podcast is going out to everybody, I mean, we used to have a good relationship with Valet and Dave, and then all of a sudden that we would email to test boards, and we tried to get them into our split board test last year, and they just went crickets, and it was like, okay, well, I'm not going to take it personally. You know, something's obviously going on over there, and it's business, you know, ski and snowboard. As far as your guys kit, what is there one thing in your backpack that, you know, if there's one thing that, like, you know, is that extra, like, comfort level, or, like, what, you know, obviously you've got your Beacon shovel probe, everything, you know, your avalanche stuff, but inside your kit, is there anything that you like to bring, you know, like a hot chocolate? What, you guys spend a lot of time in the mountains, like, what kind of tips can you give people?
Definitely always bring a nice warm puffy jacket.
For me, I think for both Neil and I, over the last, like, 5 or 6 years is, like, you know, these nice, lightweight puffies have come out. Just having something to, like, a really warm, light layer to throw on goes so far in terms of providing comfort. That's, like, the number one thing, really, for me, is just having, like, an ultra-light, super warm layer to throw on. It's also a safety thing, too. You know, if one of your buddies gets hurt back there, and then you've got this warm extra layer you can throw on for them, and there's a lot of little things, you know, but that would be at the top of the list for sure.
Snacks, that's essential.
Yeah, snacks, but, like, I sometimes will go out in a day and hardly eat anything, hardly take any water. I'm just like, so I don't know, this is kind of the way I am, but so I don't usually, like, pack a big lunch or anything extravagant like that, unless, obviously, it's a really, really big day, but I try to keep it simple. Like, over the years, I've been slimming down my kit more and more, and just running the essentials and having as light of a rig as possible has been super helpful.
For sure. Last but not least, you said you were down in Nicaragua surfing. Do you guys both surf?
Yeah, we both surf. You know, we've been getting into it more. You know, for a while we used to just kind of dabble, you know, like maybe one trip a year at the most, you know, just for a few days. But like around 4 years ago, my brothers and I, along with our dad, invested in a little farm in Nicaragua. So we've just all of a sudden been spending a lot more time down there. And, of course, really, really, really good surfing down there pretty much year-round. So it's kind of just been like the last missing puzzle piece, you know, for us, being so passionate about board riding. You know, once we really figured out surfing, it was like, oh, okay, now everything makes sense. You know, it all connects in some way. Like, you can draw inspiration and sort of technique from every one of these different board sports. So that's been super fun.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons we love the powder surfing. And so it's really cool that you guys got that in the segment for Warren Miller. And I figured that you guys must have had some experience surfing, because if you've never paddled out in the ocean and you try to jump on a pow surfer, you might be able to pull it off. But it seems like you said, having that, you know, skateboard, surf, snow, it's all so similar. Yeah. Even skiing versus snowboarding, using edges and just floating down the mountain.
Exactly. Yeah. I think not having one, you gotta have kind of two out of three, it seems like, to be able to top on those boards and kind of figure it out for sure, yeah. Or else it's just a lot steeper of a learning curve for sure. Just having a background in skateboarding and snowboarding is probably the most important thing. And surfing is just the way that the board glides, and figuring out how to keep your board from kind of going under the snow. And just mixing all three of them is really important. I think pow surfing is probably like the main thing that connects all of them together. Like, I have most similarities of all the different board sports combined into the one. So that's why it's been the most like refreshing and exhilarating for me, is because it's just kind of like a combination of everything.
For sure. Yeah, a couple years ago I was in Haines, and I asked them if I could take a pow surfer up one of the runs, and they just looked at me like, absolutely not. And I said, well, why not? They said, well, Willet is the only buddy that we've let up in the bird with the pow surfer. But I think eventually that's, as you guys said, you know, you're going splitboarding with them now, right?
It's going to change for sure, because obviously you can't pow surf up in Alaska or anywhere for that matter all the time. Like, it's very condition dependent. It has to be just right. But if the conditions are right, then why not, you know? So I think that mentality is changing. Like, there's some resorts here in Utah that'll allow you to ride your pow surfer as long as you have a leash.
Wow.
And you know, like, places like, you know, Mustang Powder up in BC and Metallic Lodge up in BC. If you're legit and you know what you're doing, it's all good, you know? So, there's just a few places, that you can do it now, but, I don't know, maybe in the future, some of those heli ops and cat ops, will be more accommodating, which would be great.
Awesome, guys. Well, I appreciate the chat, and, definitely wish you guys the best of the winter. It looks like we got a big La Nina coming, and we had written an article a couple weeks ago saying that the forecast we're seeing looks like it's going to be wetter and colder than last winter. So fingers crossed that comes through.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah.
Super stoked. Hopefully, I haven't really spent much time up in your neck of the woods, but hopefully you get a chance to come up there one of these days.
Well, please do, and I'll be sure to give you guys my contact info, and then, if you come up this way, I'd love to take you out touring, and vice versa, if I'm down that way, I'll be sure to look you guys up.
Right on, man. It was great chatting with you, Mike.
Yep. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that was a great interview with Ian and Neil Provo. Again, those guys are just absolute legends as of late. If you don't know about them, be sure to look them up. John Jackson. What's up with John Jackson? John Jackson, he's been riding for Signal Snowboards for the past couple seasons, helped them design a split board. And then all of a sudden, I see a photo of John Jackson with a Jones Carbon Solution split board way deep in the backcountry of Tahoe. I've reached out to the PR firm that represents Jones Snowboards, and they said that John Jackson is not on Jones Snowboards. We shall see. Again, there's a photo of John Jackson with the Carbon Solution in the backcountry. He's got his Red Bull, Under Armour, all his stickers are on there. So again, it's a little interesting to see. Maybe I'm breaking some news that I shouldn't be, but whatever, this is the industry. More industry news, Skull Candy. Skull Candy's owner, Rick Alden, is selling his house in Park City, Utah. If you have $18.9 million, this is a great investment, and it comes with 300 snowboards. Not only is he selling his house, the guy's selling his snowboard collection. This place is wild. This house is legendary. They throw raging Mormon parties. Well, kind of. But anyway, it's a fun place. It's part of snowboard history. $18.9 million, and you can actually own Rick Alden's house, owner of Skull Candy. Instagram. How many of you guys are on Instagram? I am not. I don't use a smartphone, so I can't really use Instagram. We had tried to run an Instagram account for the Mountain Weekly News, but I didn't really feel like sitting at home on my desktop using Instagram. As well as the platform, I think, sucks. So that's just me speaking personally. I don't use it. We don't use it for our brand. I've now had two companies within the industry decide to not work with us or value the Mountain Weekly News website because of our lack of Instagram presence. This is complete and utter bullshit. Thank you, Rome Snowboards and D-Day Snowboards. Honestly, it's going to take a lot for me to ever work with you guys just because you called me out for not having an Instagram account. So it's a two-way street. So now I'm calling you out. So if you want to be all marketing savvy and this and that, jump on Instagram. But for me and for what I do, it doesn't help our business. And when I'm outside in the mountains, I want to be present, not taking photos so that other people can like it and share it and I would give it bubbles. I don't know what Instagram does, to be honest. I've never been on the cell phone side of things. So anyway, thanks again, Rome Snowboards and D-Day Snowboards. I wish you guys the best of luck moving forward. Ooh, we've got some more fun industry news. This is Torstein Horgemo. I wanted you to listen in to part of his vlog that he has just done. It came out October 30th. Basically, Torstein wants to explain some stuff about the industry and why he's deciding to go the route in the direction that he is. So check this out.
What about your pro career? No more contests? Okay, so I guess this is announcement time. I'm officially not competing anymore. I'm done with the medal chase. I'm only focusing on filming. And here's why. And I think I got a question for you at the end of this too. So I got hooked on snowboarding 100% because of the videos. I just wanted to live that lifestyle, dreaming of maybe one day making it to the point where I could be in one of those videos and inspire like that. But where I'm from in Norway, there's no way you can make a name for yourself without doing contests to begin with. So I started doing a bunch of events around Norway and did well enough to get invited to bigger events down in Europe. And at the same time, at every event I did, if I saw anyone filming it with a decent rig, I would walk right up to that person and be like, hey, that's a sick camera. Who are you filming for? Hi, my name is Torstein. After the event is over, do you want to go film some shit? I was that annoying kid. But that actually led me to filming for Factor Films in Norway for a while. Shout out to Petter and the Storbis crew who got me on my first trip to the US. Shout out to Thomas. And on that same trip, I actually managed to sneak into Super Park at Keystone, where I coincidentally met the global team manager for DC. So I had a couple of European podiums under my belt and started getting invited to bigger events like the Arctic Challenge, X Games, Aaron Style in Europe, X Trail in Tokyo, Japan, like actually downtown Tokyo, inside Tokyo Dome. They used to pay you $5,000 just to show up, appearance fee. And the riders at these events, I'm talking Rice, Teje, Benedek, Gigi, Oksanen, Etala, just to name a few. They were all my heroes, and I got to compete with them. It never felt like I was competing against them. Everybody's main thing was filming, not just the riders, the companies, the sponsors, too. Everybody was at these huge events as a side thing, and it was great. Nobody was copying anybody, all unique styles, and for me to be there, just even as a spectator, it was like watching a brand new video part live. So I got on the AMP team for DC and Oakley, and they both helped me get on the crew for Standard Films, my first major film company. Holy shit. Keep in mind, I was like winning contests on the side the whole time, and it's hard to say no to more contests when you're doing well, and everybody's telling you you should keep going. Fast forward whatever amount of years, snowboarding's changing, more mainstream, and I get sucked into contests becoming the main thing. It seemed like it started becoming the main focus for all the big sponsor companies too, like that's where the money started going. So in a nutshell, it all just started becoming a lot more competitive. More events, more riders, more schedules, national teams become a thing, and the coaches. I will never forget the first time I saw a coach standing at the top of the slopestyle drop-in with a notepad, writing down what all the top riders were doing so that he could design a winning run for his own riders. I mean, what the fuck? So this obviously leads to shit becoming really repetitive because the riders are being told what to do. Not all of them, but there's definitely like a winning formula being developed. Bottom line, snowboarding to me is not supposed to be on a schedule, and I got tired of riding on a flight itinerary, an event practice schedule, or a live TV schedule. When some random dude I don't know is commanding me to drop in 3 seconds because TV is waiting and I can't even see the first jump, it's snowing so hard. All of my biggest injuries all stem in some shape or form from being tied to those schedules and not riding more on my own, doing what I truly like to do with snowboarding. My favorite thing is riding powder and learning stupid new rail tricks. It's never been about the money for me. I just really, really love snowboarding and I just want to share it in the best possible way that I can. That's why, for me, filming and creating edits come before contests, and I'm in it to get people excited about snowboarding.
Well, Torstein pretty much broke it down. That's a side of the industry that we don't really hear a lot about, but it is. I can only imagine, like you said, that last part where he's standing at the top of the X Games and, you know, not really sure if he wants to drop in, and some guy's like, 3, 2, 1, go. That's a good way to get broken off. So congrats to Torstein for being at a point in his career where he can just bail. Craig Kelly was one of the first to do that. He was doing the contest. He was really successful. And he said, you know what? I'm going to go a completely different direction. It's inspiring. Not a lot of people can pull it off. Right on, Torstein. Okay. A couple more, tidbits about gear. DPS is a ski company. DPS is coming out with the Phantom Wax. This thing has already generated about $80,000 via their Kickstarter campaign. Basically, this is a one-time wax application on your skis or snowboard that'll last for life. It is non-toxic to the environment. Again, lifetime ski wax, one-time application. The one thing I am hearing about this is it does require a base grind of your snowboard or skis after 30 days on snow. So depending on how many days you use your board, you might need to get it base ground a couple times. But to not have to wax your board or skis throughout the season, that's pretty awesome. However, some of us do enjoy the going out and waxing a board or skis and scraping. And that is a fun feeling. It could become that could be something ancient if this takes off. So congrats to DPS for putting out that amazing Phantom Wax. Also, as far as gear, I'm trying to see what else we're testing right now. We got all sorts of stuff here. I've really been digging the Burton AK stuff, the Burton AK jacket, as well as the backpack. The Burton AK backpack probably is my favorite backpack that I've ever used. And every time I put that backpack on, I'm just surprised at how well it fits, how many different features it has. It's got that you can open it from the top and kind of stuff everything down. Then it's got the back panel. I mean, this thing it's an incredible backpack. So I'll talk more about that soon. Next week, I've got a story about the Tordillo Mountain Lodge. We actually have an interview with Olympic gold medalist and silver medalist skier, Olympic medalist Tommy Moe. Tommy Moe is going to be on the show. He's a part owner of Tordillo Mountain Lodge, and we're going to basically talk about a new service that they have called helicopter biking. So if you're a mountain biker or just somebody that's looking for something different to try out, helicopter biking is available up at Tordillo Mountain Lodge, and that's something we'll be talking about next week. So again, thanks for tuning in. This was episode number 20 of Everything Snowboarding and More. Ian, Neil, appreciate you guys being on the show. And be sure to tune back in. Again, this is Mike with the Mountain Weekly News. Have a great day. Peace.